installed and decided to visit Dylan Ruddock, the super. Dylan and I were buds. Being that we were just about the only two people in the building who didn't think Metamucil was one of the four major food groups. Dylan moved his lips when he read the funnies, but put a tool in the man's hand and he was pure genius. He lived in the bowels of the building, in a carpeted efficiency that never saw the natural light of day. There was a constant background serenade as boilers and water heaters rumbled and water swished through the pipes. Dylan said he liked it, said he pretended it was the ocean. "Hey, Dylan," I said when he answered the door. "How's it going?"
"Going okay. Can't complain. What can I do for you?"
"I'm worried about crime, Dylan. I thought it would be a good idea to get another deadbolt put on my door."
"That's cool," he said. "A person can never be too careful. In fact, I just finished putting a deadbolt on Mrs. Luger's door. She said some big, huge guy was yelling in the halls late at night, a couple days ago.
Said it scared the whatever out of her.
Maybe you heard him, too. Mrs. Luger's just two doors down from you."
I resisted the urge to swallow and go, gulp. I knew the name of the big, huge guy.
"I'll try to get the lock on tomorrow," Dylan said. "In the meantime, how about a beer?"
"A beer would be good." Dylan handed me a bottle and a can of mixed nuts. He boosted the sound back up on the TV, and we both plopped down on the couch. I'd set my alarm for 8, but I was up at 7, anxious to find the van. I took a shower and spent some time on my hair, doing the blow-drying thing, adding some gel and some spray. When I was done, I looked like Cher on a bad day. Still, Cher on a bad day wasn't all that bad. I was down to my last clean pair of spandex shorts. I tugged on a matching sports bra that doubled as a halter top and slid a big, loose purple T-shirt with a large, droopy neck over my head. I laced up my high-top Reeboks, crunched down my white socks, and felt pretty cool. I ate Frosted Flakes for breakfast. If they were good enough for Tony the Tiger, they were good enough for me. I swallowed down a multivitamin, brushed my teeth, poked a couple of big gold hoops through my earlobes, applied glow-in-the-dark cherry red lipstick, and I was ready to go. Cicadas droned their early warning of another scorcher day, and the blacktop steamed with what was left of morning dew. I pulled out of the lot into the steady stream of traffic on St. James. I had the map spread out on the seat next to me, plus a steno pad I'd begun to use for phone numbers, addresses, and miscellaneous bits of information relating to the job. Ramirez's apartment building was set in the middle of the block, its identity lost in a crush of four-story walk-ups built cheek by jowl for the working poor. Most likely, the building had originally held immigrant laborers, Irish, Italian, Polish hopefuls barged up the Delaware to work in Trenton's factories. It was difficult to tell who lived here now. There were no old men loitering on front stoops, no children playing on the sidewalk. Two middle-aged Asian women stood waiting at a bus stop, their purses held tight against their chests, their faces expressionless. There were no vans in sight, and no place to hide one. No garages or alleys. If Morelli was keeping tabs on Ramirez, it would have to be from the rear or from an adjacent apartment. I drove around the corner and found the single-lane service road that cut the block. There were no garages back here, either. An asphalt slab had been laid tight to the rear of Ramirez's building. Diagonal parking for 6 cars had been lined off on the slab. Only 4 cars were parked. 3 old clunkers and a silver Porsche with a license plate holder that had "The Champ" printed on it in gold. None of the cars were occupied. Across the service road were more tenement-type apartments. This would be a reasonable place for Morelli to watch or listen, I thought. But there was no sign of him. I drove through the service road and circled the block, methodically enlarging the area until I'd covered all drivable streets for a 9-block square. The van didn't turn up. I headed for Stark Street and repeated the procedure, looking for the van. There were garages and alleys here, so I parked the Cherokee and set out on foot. By 12:30, I'd snooped in enough broken-down, smelly garages to last me a lifetime. If I crossed my eyes, I could see my nose peeling. My hair was sticking to the back of my sweaty neck, and I had bursitis from carrying my hulking shoulder bag. By the time I got back to the Cherokee, my feet felt like they were on fire. I leaned against the car and checked to make sure my soles weren't melting. A block away, I could see Lula and Jackie staking out their corner. I figured it wouldn't hurt to talk to them again.
"Still looking for Morelli?" Lula asked.
I shoved my dark glasses to the top of my head.
"Have you seen him?"
"No. Haven't heard nothing about him either. Man's keeping a low profile."
"How about his van?"
"Don't know nothing about a van. Lately, Morelli's been driving a red and gold Cherokee. Like the one you're driving."
Her eyes widened.
"Shit. That ain't Morelli's car, is it?"
"I sort of borrowed it." Lula's face split in a grin.
"Honey, you telling me you stole Morelli's car? Girl, he gonna kick your skinny white butt."
"A couple days ago, I saw him driving a faded blue Econoline," I said. "It had antennae sticking out all over the place. You see anything like that cruise by?"
"We didn't see nothing," Jackie said.
I turned to Lula. "How about you, Lula? You see a blue van?"
"Tell me the truth now. You really pregnant?" Lula asked.
"No. But I could have been 14 years ago."
"So what's going on here? What you really want with Morelli?"
"I work for his bondsman. Morelli is FTA.
"No shit. There any money in that?"
10% of the bond."
"I could do that," Lula said. "Maybe I should change my profession."
"Maybe you should stop talking and look like you want to give some before your old man beats the crap out of you," Jackie said.
I drove back to my apartment, ate some more frosted flakes, and called my mother.
"I made a nice big pot of stuffed cabbages," she said. "You should come for supper."
"Sounds good, but I have things to do."
"Like what? What's so important you can't take time to eat some stuffed cabbages?"
"Work."
"What kind of work? Are you still trying to find the Morelli boy?"
"Yeah."
"You should get a different job. I saw a sign at Clara's Beauty Salon. They need a shampoo girl."
I could hear my Grandma Mazur yelling something in the background.
"Oh, yeah," my mother said. "You had a phone call this morning from that boxer you went to see, Benito Ramirez? Your father was so excited. Such a nice young man, so polite."
"What did Ramirez want?"
"He said he'd been trying to get in touch with you, but your phone had been disconnected. I told him it was okay now."
I mentally banged my head against the wall. Benito Ramirez is a sleaze. If he calls up again, don't talk to him.
He was polite on the phone.
Yeah, I thought. The most courteous, homicidal rapist in Trenton. And now he knew he could call me.
Chapter 8.
My apartment building was pre-laundry room vintage, and the present owner felt no compulsion to add amenities. The nearest coin-op, Super Suds, was about a half mile away on Hamilton. Not a journey of insurmountable proportions, but a pain in the ass all the same. I tucked the stack of FTAs I'd received from Connie into my pocketbook and slung my pocketbook over my shoulder. I lugged my laundry basket into the hall, locked my door, and hauled myself out to the car. As far as laundromats went, Super Suds wasn't bad. There was parking in a small lot to the side of the building, and a luncheonette next door where a person could get a tasty chicken salad sandwich if a person had cash on hand. I happened to be low on cash on hand, so I dumped my laundry into a machine, added detergent and quarters, and settled down to review my FTAs. Lonnie Dodd was at the top of the stack and seemed like the easiest apprehension. He was 22 and lived in Hamilton Township. He'd been charged with auto theft, a first-time offender. I used the laundromat payphone to call Connie to verify that Dodd was still outstanding. "He's probably in his garage changing his oil," she said. "Happens all the time. It's one of those man things. Hell," they say to themselves, "nobody's going to push me around. All I did was steal a few cars. What's the big fucking deal?" So they don't show up for the court date. I thanked Connie for her insight and returned to my chair. As soon as my laundry was done, I'd mosey on over to Dodd's place and see if I could find him. I slid the files back into my pocketbook and transferred my clothes to the dryer. I sat down, looked out the big plate glass front window, and the blue van rolled by. I was so startled I froze, mouth open, eyes glazed, mind blank. Not what you would call a quick draw. The van disappeared down the street, and in the distance I could see the brake lights go on. Morelli was stopped in traffic. Now I moved. Actually, I think I flew, because I don't remember my feet touching pavement. I peeled out of the lot smoking rubber. I got to the corner and the alarm went off. In my haste, I'd forgotten to punch in the code. I could barely think for the noise. The key was on my key ring, and the key ring was attached to the key in the ignition. I slammed my foot on the brake, fishtailing to a stop in the middle of the road. I looked in the rearview mirror after the fact, relieved to find there were no cars behind me. I deactivated the alarm and took off again. Several cars were between me and Morelli. He turned right, and I gripped the wheel tighter, creeping along, inventing colorful new expletives as I made my way to the intersection. By the time I turned, he was gone. I slowly worked my way up and down the streets. I was ready to quit when I spotted the van parked in the back lot to Manny's Deli. I stopped at the entrance to the lot and stared at the van, wondering what to do next. I had no way of knowing if Morelli was behind the wheel. He could be stretched out in the back taking a snooze, or he could be in Manny's ordering tuna on a Kaiser to go. Probably I should park and investigate. If it turned out he wasn't in the van, I'd hide behind one of the cars and gas him when he came into range. I pulled into a slot at the back of the lot, four cars down from the van, and cut the engine. I was about to reach for my bag when suddenly the driver's door was ripped open and I was yanked from behind the wheel. I stumbled forward, slamming into the wall of Morelli's chest. "Looking for me?" he asked. "You might as well give up," I told him, "because I never will." The line of his mouth tightened. "Tell me about it. Suppose I lay down on the pavement and you run over me a few times with my own car, just for old times. Would you like that? Do you get your money dead or alive?" "No reason to get testy about it. I have a job to do. It's nothing personal." "Nothing personal? You've harassed my mother, stolen my car, and now you're telling people I've gotten you pregnant? In my opinion, getting someone pregnant is pretty fucking personal. Jesus, isn't it enough I'm accused of murder? What are you, the bounty hunter from hell?" "You're overwrought." "I'm beyond overwrought. I'm resigned. Everyone has a cross to bear. You're mine. I give up.
take the car. I don't care anymore. All I ask is that you try not to get too many dings on the door and you change the oil when the red light goes on. His eyes flicked to the car interior. You're not making phone calls, are you?
No, of course not.
Phone calls are expensive.
Not to worry.
Shit, he said. My life is shit.
Probably this is just a phase.
His expression softened. I like this outfit you're wearing.
He hooked a finger around the wide neck of my T-shirt and looked inside at the black spandex sports bra.
Very sexy.
A flash of heat shot through my stomach. I told myself it was anger, but I suspect carnal panic would be closer to the truth. I smacked his hand away.
Don't be rude. Well, hell, I made you pregnant, remember? One more little intimacy shouldn't bother you.
He moved closer.
I like the lipstick, too. Cherry red. Very tempting.
He lowered his mouth and kissed me.
I know I should have kneed him in the groin, but the kiss was delicious. Joe Morelli still knew how to kiss.
It had started out slow and tender in the beginning, and it had ended up hot and deep. He pulled back and smiled, and I knew I'd been had.
Gotcha, he said.
Dick breath. He reached around me and removed the keys from the ignition.
I don't want you following.
Furthest thought from my mind.
Yeah? Well, I'm going to slow you down a little anyway.
He walked to the deli's dumpster and pitched the keys inside.
Happy hunting, he said, heading for the van. Make sure you wipe your feet before you get in my car.
Wait a minute, I yelled after him. I have some questions. I want to know about the murder. I want to know about Carmen Sanchez. And is it true there's a contract out on you?
He hitched himself up into the van and drove out of the lot.
The dumpster was industrial-sized, 5 feet high, 5 feet wide, and 6 feet long. I stood on tiptoe and peered over the side. It was one quarter full and smelled like dead dog. I couldn't see the keys. A lesser woman would have burst into tears. A smarter woman would have had an extra set of keys. I dragged a wooden crate to the side of the dumpster and stood on it for a better look. Most of the garbage was bagged. Some of the bags had split on impact, spewing out half-eaten subs, globs of potato salad, coffee grounds, grill grease, unrecognizable slop, and heads of lettuce turning to primordial ooze. I was reminded of roadkill. Ashes to ashes. Mayo to its various components. Doesn't matter whether it's cats or coleslaw, death is not attractive. I did a rundown of everyone I knew, but I couldn't think of anyone dumb enough to climb into the dumpster for me. Okay, I told myself, now or never. I swung my leg up and over the side and hung there for a moment, gathering courage. I lowered myself slowly, upper lip curled. If I smelled even the hint of rat breath, I was out of there. Cans rolled underfoot, giving way to soft, squishy gunk. I felt myself slide and hooked a hand onto the dumpster rim, cracking my elbow against the side in the process. I swore and blinked back tears. I found a plastic bread bag that was relatively clean and used it like a glove to carefully paw through the slop, moving cautiously, scared to death I'd fall face first into the artichoke and calf brains vinaigrette. The amount of discarded food was sobering, the wastefulness almost as revolting as the all-pervasive odor of rot that seared the inside of my nose and clung to the roof of my mouth. After what seemed like an eternity, I discovered the keys sunk into some yellow-brown glop. I didn't see any Pampers nearby, so I hoped the glop was mustard. I stuck my bagged hand in whatever it was and gagged. I held my breath, tossed the keys over the edge onto the blacktop, and didn't waste any time following. I wiped off the keys as best as I could with the bread bag. Most of the yellow stuff came off, rendering the keys good enough for emergency driving. I got out of my shoes by stepping on the heels, and I used the two-finger sissy approach to peel my socks away. I inspected the rest of me. Aside from some Thousand Island dressing smeared on the front of my shirt, I seemed unscathed. Newspapers had been stacked for recycling beside the dumpster. I covered the driver's seat with the sports section, just in case I'd miss some noxious substance stuck to my ass. I spread paper over the passenger side floor mat and gingerly set my shoes and socks in the center. I glanced at the remaining section of paper, and a headline jumped out at me. Local man killed in drive-by shooting. Beneath the headline was a picture of John Cusack. I'd seen him on Wednesday. Today was Friday. The paper in my hand was a day old. I read the story without breathing. Cusack had been gunned down late Wednesday night in front of his apartment building. It went on to say how he'd been a hero in Nam, getting the Purple Heart, and how he was a colorful, well-liked neighborhood figure. As of press time, the police had no suspect and no motive. I leaned against the Cherokee, trying to absorb the reality of John Cusack's death. He'd been so big and alive when I'd spoken to him. And now he was dead. First, Edelman, the hit and run, and now Cusack. Of the three people who'd seen and remembered the missing witness, two were dead. I thought about Mrs. Santiago and her children and shivered. I carefully folded the paper and slid it into the map pocket. When I got back to my apartment, I'd call Gazara and try to get some reassurance of Mrs. Santiago's safety. I was beyond being able to smell myself, but I drove with the windows down as a precaution. I parked in the laundromat lot and slipped in barefoot to get my clothes. Only one other person was in the room, an elderly woman at the folding table on the far wall. "Oh, my goodness," she said, looking bewildered. "What is that smell?" I felt my cheeks heat up. "Must be outside," I said. "Must have followed me in when I opened the door."
"It's awful,"
I sniffed, but I couldn't smell anything. My nose had shut down in self-defense. I glanced at my shirt. "Does it smell like Thousand Island dressing?" She had a pillowcase pressed to her face.
"I think I'm going to be sick."
I ran my laundry into the basket and made my exit. Halfway home, I stopped for a light and noticed my eyes were watering. Ominous, I thought. Fortunately, no one was afoot when I swung into the parking lot to my apartment building. The foyer and the elevator were both empty. So far, so good. The elevator doors opened to the second floor, and no one was about there either. I breathed a sigh of relief, dragged my laundry to the door, slunk into my apartment, stripped off my clothes, and tied them up in a big black plastic garbage bag. I jumped into the shower and lathered and scrubbed and shampooed thrice. I dressed in clean clothes and went across the hall to Mr. Wileski as a test. He opened the door and instantly clamped a hand over his nose.
"Whoa," he gasped. "What's that smell?"
"That's what I was wondering," I said. "It seems to be hanging in the hall here."
"Smells like dead dog,"
I sighed. "Yeah, that was my first impression, too." I retreated back to my apartment. I needed to rewash everything, and I'd run out of quarters. I was going to have to go home to do my laundry. I looked at my watch. It was almost 6.
I call my mother on the car phone and warn her I'd be there for dinner after all. I parked in front of the house, and my mother appeared like magic, driven by some mysterious maternal instinct always to know when her daughter set foot on the curb.
"A new car," she said. "How nice. Where did you get it?"
I had the basket under one arm and the plastic trash bag under the other. "I borrowed it from a friend."
"Who?"
"You don't know him. Someone I went to school with."
"Well, you're lucky to have friends like that.
You should bake him something. A cake." I pushed past her, heading for the cellar stairs.
"I brought my laundry. I hope you don't mind."
"Of course I don't mind. What's that smell? Is that you? You smell like a garbage can." I accidentally dropped my keys in a dumpster and I had to climb in and get them out.
"I don't understand how these things happen to you. They don't happen to anyone else. Who else do you know drop their keys in a dumpster?
No one, that's who. Only you would do such a thing."
Grandma Mazur came out of the kitchen.
"I smell throw up."
"It's Stephanie," my mother said.
"She was in a dumpster."
"What was she doing in a dumpster? Was she looking for bodies? I saw a movie on TV where the mob splattered some guy's brains all over the place and then left him for rat food in a dumpster."
"She was looking for her keys," my mother told Grandma Mazur. "It was an accident."
"Well, that's disappointing," Grandma Mazur said. "I expected something better from her."
When we were done eating, I called Eddie Gazzara, put the second load of laundry in the dryer, and hosed down my shoes and my keys. I sprayed the inside of the Jeep with Lysol and opened the windows wide. The alarm wasn't usable with the windows open, but I didn't think I was running much risk of the car being reclaimed from in front of my parents' house. I took a shower and dressed in clean clothes fresh from the dryer. I was spooked by John Cusack's death, and not anxious to walk into a dark apartment. So I made a point of getting home early. I just locked the door behind me when the phone rang. The voice was muffled, so that I had to strain to hear, squinting at the handset as if that would help. Fear is not a logical emotion. No one can physically hurt me on the phone, but I flinched all the same when I realized it was Ramirez. I immediately hung up, and when the phone rang again, I snapped the plug from the wall jack. I needed an answering machine to monitor my calls, but I couldn't afford to buy one until I made a recovery. First thing in the morning, I was going to have to go after Lonnie Dodd. I awoke to the steady drumming of rain on my fire escape. Wonderful. Just what I needed to complicate my life further. I crawled out of bed and pulled the curtain aside, not pleased at the sight of an all-day soaker. The parking lot had slicked up, reflecting light from mysterious sources. The rest of the world was gunmetal gray, the cloud cover low and unending, the buildings robbed of color behind the rain. I showered and dressed in jeans and a T-shirt, letting my hair dry on its own. No sense fussing when I was going to get drenched the instant I stepped out of the building. I did the breakfast thing, brushed my teeth, and applied a nice thick line of turquoise eyeliner to offset the gloom. I was wearing my dumpster shoes in honor of the rain. I looked down and sniffed. Maybe I smelled a hint of boiled ham, but all things considered, I didn't think that was so bad. I did a pocketbook inventory, making sure I had all my goodies. Cuffs, bludgeoning baton, flashlight, gun, extra ammo. Not much good to me since I'd already forgotten how to load the gun. Still, you never knew when you might need something heavy to throw at an escaping felon. I crammed Dodd's file in along with a collapsible umbrella and a package of peanut butter crackers for emergency snacking. I grabbed the ultra-cool black and purple Gore-Tex jacket I'd purchased when I was of the privileged working class, and I headed for the parking lot.
This was the sort of day to read comic books under a blanket tent and eat the icing from the middle of the Oreos. This was not the sort of day to chase down desperados. Unfortunately, I was hard up for money and couldn't be choosy about selecting desperado days. Lonnie Dodd's address was listed as 2115 Barnes. I hauled my map out and looked up the coordinates. Hamilton Township is about 3 times the size of Trenton proper, and roughly shaped like a wedge of pie that suffered some nibbles. Barnes ran with its back pressed to the Conrail tracks just north of Yardville, the beginning of the lower third of the county. I took Chambers to Broad and cut up on Apollo. Barnes struck off from Apollo. The sky had lightened marginally, and it was possible to read house numbers as I drove. The closer I got to 2115, the more depressed I became. Property value was dropping at a frightening rate. What had begun as a respectable blue-collar neighborhood with trim single-family bungalows on good-sized lots had deteriorated to neglected low-income to no-income housing. 2115 was at the end of the street. The grass was overgrown and had gone to seed. A rusted bike and a washing machine with its top lid askew decorated the front yard. The house itself was a small cinder block rancher built on a slab. It looked to be more of an outbuilding than a home. Something intended for chickens or porkers. A sheet had been tacked haphazardly over the front picture window, probably to afford the inhabitants privacy while they crushed cans of bullseye beer against their foreheads and plotted mayhem. I told myself it was now or never. Rain pattered on the roof and sluiced down the windshield. I pumped myself up by applying fresh lipstick. There was no great surge of power, so I deepened the blue liner and added mascara and blush. I checked myself out in the rearview mirror. Wonder Woman, eat your heart out. Yeah, right. I studied Dodd's picture one last time. Didn't want to overwhelm the wrong man. I dropped my keys into my pocketbook, pulled my hood up, and got out of the car. I knocked on the door and caught myself secretly hoping no one was home. The rain and the neighborhood and the grim little house were giving me the creeps. If the second knock goes unanswered, I thought, I'll consider it the will of God that I'm not destined to catch Dodd, and I'll get the hell out of here. No one answered on the second knock. But I'd heard a toilet flush, and I knew someone was in there. Damn. I gave the door a few good shots with my fist. "Open up!" I yelled at the top of my voice. "Pizza delivery!" A skinny guy with dark, tangled, shoulder-length hair answered the door. He was a couple inches taller than me. He was barefoot and shirtless, wearing a pair of filthy, low-slung jeans that were unsnapped and only half-zipped. Beyond him, I could see a trash-filled living room. The air drifting out was pungent with cat fumes. "I didn't order no pizza," he said. "Are you Lonnie Dodd?" "Yeah. What's with the pizza delivery shit?" "It was a ploy to get you to answer your door." "A what?" "I work for Vincent Plum, your bond agent. You missed your trial, and Mr. Plum would like you to reschedule." "Fuck that. I'm not rescheduling nothing." The rain was running off my jacket and sheets, soaking my jeans and shoes. "It would only take a few minutes. I'd be happy to drive you." "Plum doesn't have no limo service. Plum only hires 2 kinds of people. Women with big pointy tits and scumbag bounty hunters. Nothing personal, and it's hard to see with that raincoat on. But you don't look like you got big pointy tits. That leaves scumbag bounty hunter." Without warning, he reached out into the rain, grabbed my pocketbook off my shoulder, and tossed the contents onto the tan shag carpet behind him. The gun landed with a thunk. "You could get into a lot of crap carrying concealed in this state," he said. I narrowed my eyes.
Are you going to cooperate here?
What do you think?
I think if you're smart, you'll get a shirt and some shoes and come downtown with me.
Guess I'm not that smart.
Fine. Then just give me my stuff and I'll be more than happy to leave. Truer words were never spoken.
I'm not giving you nothing. This here stuff looks like my stuff now.
I was debating kicking him in the nuts when he gave me a shove to the chest, knocking me backward off the small cement pad. I came down hard on my ass in the mud.
Take a hike, he said, or I'll shoot you with your own fucking gun.
The door slammed shut and the bolt clicked into place. I got up and wiped my hands on my jacket. I couldn't believe I just stood there flat-footed and let him take my shoulder bag. What had I been thinking? I'd been thinking about Clarence Sampson and not about Lonnie Dodd. Lonnie Dodd wasn't a fat drunk. I should have approached him with a much more defensive posture. I should have stood further back, out of his reach. And I should have had my defense spray in my hand, not in my pocketbook. I had a lot to learn as a bounty hunter. I lacked skills, but even more problematic, I lacked attitude. Ranger had tried to tell me, but it hadn't taken hold. Never let your guard down, he'd said. When you walk the street, you have to see everything, every second. You let your mind wander, and you could be dead. When you go after your FTA, always be prepared for the worst. It had seemed overly dramatic at the time. Looking at it in retrospect, it had been good advice. I stomped back to the Jeep and stood there fuming, swearing at myself and Dodd and E.E. Martin. I threw in a few choice thoughts about Ramirez and Morelli and kicked a tire.
Now what?
I yelled in the rain. Now what are you going to do, girl genius? Well, I sure as hell wasn't going to leave without Lonnie Dodd shackled and stuffed into my back seat. As I saw it, I needed help, and I had two choices, the police or Ranger. If I called the police, I might be in trouble with the gun. It'd have to be Ranger. I closed my eyes. I really didn't want to call Ranger. I wanted to do this myself. I wanted to show everyone I was capable. Pride goeth before the fall, I said. I wasn't sure exactly what that meant, but it felt right. I took a deep, groaning breath, shucked the muddy, dripping, wet raincoat, slid behind the wheel and called Ranger.
Yo,
he said. I have a problem.
Are you naked?
No, I'm not naked.
Too bad.
I have an FTA cornered in his house, but I'm not having any luck making an apprehension.
You want to be more specific about the not having any luck part?
He took my pocketbook and kicked me out of the house. Pause.
I don't suppose you managed to keep your gun.
Don't suppose I did. On the bright side, the gun wasn't loaded.
You have ammo in your pocketbook?
I might have had a few loose bullets rolling around.
Where are you now?
In front of the house, in the Jeep.
And you want me to come over there and persuade your FTA to behave?
Yeah.
Good thing for you I'm into this Henry Higgins shit. What's the address?
I gave him the address and hung up feeling disgusted with myself. I'd virtually armed my FTA, and now I was sending Ranger in to clean up the mess I'd made of things. I was going to have to get smarter, faster. I was going to have to learn how to load the damn gun. And I was going to learn how to shoot it. I might not ever have the guts to shoot Joe Morelli, but I was pretty sure I could shoot Lonnie Dodd. I watched the clock on the dash, waiting for Ranger, anxious to resolve this unfinished business.
10 minutes passed before his Mercedes appeared at the end of the street, gliding through the rain, sleek and sinister, water not daring to adhere to the paint finish. We simultaneously got out of our cars. He wore a black baseball cap, tight black jeans, and a black T-shirt. He strapped on his black nylon gun belt and holster, the gun held tight to his leg by a black Velcro strap. At first glance, he'd pass for a SWAT cop. He shrugged into a Kevlar vest.
What's the FDA's name?
Lonnie Dodd.
You got a photo?
I ran to the Jeep, pulled out Dodd's picture, and gave it to Ranger.
What'd he do?
Ranger wanted to know.
Auto theft. First-time offender.
He alone? As far as I know, I can't guarantee it.
This house have a back door?
Don't know.
Let's find out.
We took a direct route to the back, cutting through the tall grass, keeping our eyes on the front door, watching the windows for movement. I hadn't bothered with my jacket. It seemed like an unnecessary encumbrance at this point. My energies were directed at catching Dodd. I was soaked to the skin, and it was liberating to know I couldn't get any wetter. The backyard was similar to the front. Tall grass, a rusted swing set, 2 garbage cans overflowing with garbage, their dented lids lying on the ground nearby. A back door opened to the yard. Ranger pulled me close to the building, out of window sight.
You stay here and watch the back door. I'm going in the front. I don't want you to be a hero. You see anybody run for the train tracks, you keep out of their way. Got that?
Water dripped from the tip of my nose.
Sorry to put you through this. This is partly my fault. I haven't been taking you serious enough. If you're really going to do this job, you're going to need somebody to help you with the takedown. And we need to spend some time talking about apprehension techniques.
I need a partner.
Yeah. You need a partner.
He moved off, rounding the house, his footsteps muffled by the rain. I held my breath, straining to hear, catching his knock on the door, hearing him identify himself. There was obviously a reply from within, but it was lost to me. What followed after that was a blur of sound and action on fast forward. Warnings from Ranger that he was coming in. The door crashing open, a lot of shouting, a single report from a gun. The back door banged open and Lonnie Dodd charged out, heading not for the tracks, but for the next house down. He was still clad only in jeans. He was running blind in the rain, clearly panicked. I was partially hidden by a shed, and he ran right by me without a sideways glance. I could see the silver glint of a gun stuck in his waistband.
Wouldn't you know it?
On top of every other insult, now the creep was making off with my gun. $400 shot to hell, and just when I decided to learn how to use the damn thing. No way was I going to let this happen. I yelled for Ranger and took off after Dodd. Dodd wasn't that far in front of me, and I had the advantage of shoes. He was sliding in the rain-slicked grass, stepping on God knows what. He went down to one knee, and I body-slammed into the back of him, knocking us both to the ground. He hit with an thanks to 125 pounds of angry female landing on top of him. Well, okay, maybe 127, but not an ounce more, I swear. He was laboring to breathe, and I grabbed the gun, not from any defensive instinct, but out of sheer possessiveness. It was my gun, damn it. I scrambled to my feet and pointed the .38 in Dodd's direction, holding it with both hands to minimize the shaking. It never occurred to me to check for bullets.
"Don't move," I yelled. "Don't fucking move or I'll shoot."
Ranger appeared in my peripheral vision. He put his knee to the small of Dodd's back, snapped cuffs on him, and jerked him to his feet.
"The son of a bitch shot me," Ranger said. "Do you believe this lousy shit?
A lousy car thief shot me.
He shoved Dodd ahead of him toward the road.
I'm wearing a fucking Kevlar vest. You think he could shoot me in the vest? No way. He's such a lousy shot, he's so chicken shit scared he shoots me in my fucking leg.
I looked down at Ranger's leg and almost keeled over.
Run ahead and call the police, Ranger said. And call Al at the body shop to come get my car.
You sure you're going to be okay?
Flesh wound, babe. Nothing to worry about.
I made the calls, retrieved my pocketbook and assorted goods from Dodd's house, and waited with Ranger. We had Dodd trussed up like a Christmas goose, face down in the mud. Ranger and I sat on the curb in the rain. He didn't seem concerned with the seriousness of his wound. He said he'd had worse, but I could see the pain wearing him down, pinching his face. I wrapped my arms tight around myself and clamped my teeth together to keep them from chattering. Outwardly, I was keeping a stiff upper lip, trying to be as stoic as Ranger, trying to be confidently supportive. Inside, I was shaking so bad I could feel my heart shivering in my chest. Chapter 9. The cops came first, then the paramedics, then Al. We gave preliminary statements, Ranger was trundled off to the hospital, and I followed the squad car to the station. It was close to 5 by the time I reached Vinny's office. I asked Connie to write out separate checks. $50 to me, the remainder to Ranger. I wouldn't have taken any money at all, but I really needed to screen my calls, and this was the only way I could buy an answering machine. I dearly wanted to go home, take a shower, change into clean, dry clothes, and have a decent meal. I knew once I got settled in, I wasn't going to want to go out again, so I detoured to Kuntz Appliances before heading back to my apartment. Bernie was using a small roller device to paste price stickers onto a carton of alarm clocks. He looked up when I walked in the door. I need an answering machine, I told him. Something under $50. My shirt and my jeans were relatively dry by now, but my shoes still leaked water when I walked. Everywhere I stood, amoeba-like puddles formed around me. Bernie politely pretended not to notice. He shifted into salesman mode and showed me 2 models of answering machines, both in my price range. I asked which he recommended and followed his advice. MasterCard? He asked. I just got a $50 check from Vinny. Can I sign it over to you?
Sure, he said. That'll be okay.
From where I was standing, I could look out the front window, across the street, into Sal's meat market. There wasn't much to see. A shadowy display window with the name lettered in black and gold, and the single glass door with the red and white open sign affixed by a small suction cup halfway up. I imagined Bernie spending hours peering out his window, numbly staring at Sal's door.
You said Ziggy Kulesa shopped at Sal's?
Yeah. Of course, there's all kinds of shopping you can do at Sal's.
So I hear. What kind of shopping do you think Ziggy was doing?
Hard to say, but I didn't notice him coming out with bags of pork chops.
I tucked my answering machine under my shirt and ran to my car. I took a last wondering look at Sal's, and I pulled away. Traffic was slow in the rain, and I found myself mesmerized by the beat and the swish of the wiper, and the smear of red brake lights appearing in front of me. I was driving on autopilot, reviewing the day, worrying about Ranger. It's one thing to see someone shot on television. It's quite another to see the destruction firsthand. Ranger kept saying it wasn't a bad wound, but it was bad enough for me.
I owned a gun, and I was going to learn how to use it correctly. But I'd lost some of my earlier enthusiasm for pumping lead into a body. I turned into my lot and found a spot close to the building. I set the alarm and dragged myself out of the car and up the stairs. I left my shoes in the foyer and put the answering machine and my pocketbook on the kitchen counter. I cracked open a beer and called the hospital to check on Ranger. I was told he'd been treated and released. That was good news. I stuffed myself full of Ritz crackers and peanut butter, washed them down with a second beer, and staggered into my bedroom. I peeled my damp clothes away, half expecting to see that I'd started to mildew. I didn't check everywhere, but the body parts I saw looked mold-free. Hot dog, what luck. I dropped a T-shirt-type nightgown over my head, hiked up a clean pair of undies, and crashed into bed. I woke with my heart racing and not knowing why. The cobwebs parted, and I realized the phone was ringing. I fumbled for the receiver and stared stupidly at the bedside clock. 2 o'clock. Someone must have died, I thought. My Grandma Mazur, or my Aunt Sophie, or maybe my father passed a kidney stone. I answered breathless, expecting the worst. Hello? There was silence on the other end. I heard labored breathing, scuffling noises, and then someone moaned. A woman's voice carried from the distance. No, she begged.
Oh, God, no!
A terrible scream split the air, jolting the phone from my ear, and I broke out in a cold sweat as I realized what I was hearing. I slammed the receiver down and switched on my bedside light. I got out of bed on shaky legs and stumbled to the kitchen. I hooked up the answering machine and set it to answer on one ring. My recording said to leave a message. That was it. I didn't give my name. I went to the bathroom and brushed my teeth and returned to bed. The phone rang, and I heard the machine snap on. I sat up and listened. The caller crooned to me, half song, half whisper. Stephanie, he chanted. Stephanie. My hand instinctively went to my mouth. It was a reflex action designed to control the scream in primal man, but the scream had been bred out of me. What was left was a quick intake of air. Part gasp, part sob. You shouldn't have hung up, bitch, he said. You missed the best part. You gotta know what the champ can do so you can look forward to it. I ran to the kitchen, but before I could disconnect the machine, the woman came on the line. She sounded young. Her words were barely audible, thick with tears and trembling with the effort of speech.
It was good, she said.
Her voice broke.
Oh, God, help me. I'm hurt. I'm hurt something awful.
The connection was severed, and I immediately called the police. I explained the tape and told them it was originating with Ramirez. I gave them Ramirez's home address. I gave them my number if they wanted to institute a call trace. I hung up and padded around the apartment, triple-checking locked doors and windows, thankful that I'd had the deadbolt installed. The phone rang, and the machine answered. No one came on the line, but I could feel the vibrations of evil and insanity pulsing in the silence. He was out there, listening, savoring the contact, trying to get a bead on my fear. Far off, almost too faint to discern, I heard a woman softly crying. I ripped the phone plug out of the wall jack, splintering the little plastic clip. And then I threw up in the sink. Thank God for garbage disposals. I awoke at daybreak, relieved to have the night behind me. The rain had stopped. It was too early for bird chatter. There were no cars traveling St. James. It was as if the world was holding its breath, waiting for the sun to burst upon the horizon. The phone call replayed in my mind. I didn't need the recorder to remember the message. The good, sensible Stephanie wanted to file for a restraining order. Stephanie, the neophyte bounty hunter, was still worried about credibility and respect. I could hardly go running to the police every time I was threatened and then expect them to accept me as an equal. I was on record for requesting help for the abused woman on my tape. I thought about it for a while, and I decided to leave it at that for now. Later in the day, I'd give Jimmy Alpha a call. I'd intended to ask Ranger to take me to the firing range, but since he was recovering from the gunshot wound, I would have to lay the burden on Eddie Gazzara. I glanced at the clock again. Gazzara should be at work. I dialed the station and left a message for a callback. I dressed in T-shirt and shorts and laced up my running shoes. Running isn't one of my favorite activities, but it was time to get serious about the job, and keeping in shape seemed like part of it. "Go for it," I said by way of a pep talk. I trotted down the hall, the stairs, through the front door. I heaved a large sigh of resignation and pushed off on my 3-mile route, mapped out with great care to avoid hills and bakeries. I slogged through the first mile, and then it got really bad. I'm not one of those people who find their stride. My body wasn't designed to run. My body was designed to sit in an expensive car and drive. I was sweating and breathing hard when I turned the corner and saw my building half a block away. So near, and yet so far. I sprinted the last piece as best I could. I came to a ragged stop at the door and bent at the waist, waiting for my vision to clear, feeling so fucking healthy I could hardly stand myself. Eddie Gazzara pulled up to the curb in a patrol car. "I got your message," he said. "Jesus, you look like shit."
"I've been running."
"Maybe you should check with a doctor."
"It's my fair skin. It flushes easily." "Did you hear about Ranger?"
"Only every detail. You're a real hot topic. I even know what you were wearing when you came in with Dodd. I take it your T-shirt was real wet. I mean, real wet."
"When you first started out as a cop, were you afraid of your gun?"
"I've been around guns most of my life. I had an air rifle when I was a kid, and I used to go hunting with my dad and my Uncle Walt. I guess guns were always just another piece of hardware to me."
"If I decide to keep working for Vinny, you think it's necessary for me to carry a gun?"
"It depends what kind of cases you take. If you're just doing skip tracing, no. If you're going after crazies, yes. Do you have a gun?"
"Smith & Wesson, 38. Ranger gave me about 10 minutes of instruction on it, but I don't feel comfortable." "Would you be willing to babysit me while I do some target practice?"
"You're serious about this, aren't you?" "There's no other way to be."
He nodded.
"I heard about your phone call last night."
"Anything come of it?"
"Dispatch sent someone out, but by the time they got there, Ramirez was alone. Said he didn't call you. Nothing came in from the woman, but you can register a harassment charge."
"I'll think about it." I waved him off and huffed and puffed my way up the stairs. I let myself into my apartment, dug out an auxiliary phone cord, put a new tape in the answering machine, and took a shower. It was Sunday. Vinny had given me a week, and the week was up. I didn't care. Vinny could give the file to someone else, but he couldn't stop me from dogging Morelli. If someone else bagged him before I did, that was the breaks. But until that happened, I intended to keep at it. Gazzara had agreed to meet me at the pistol range behind Sonny's gun shop when he got off work at 4 o'clock. That left me with a whole day of snow.